welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Greg Braden, the author of Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. Greg has many other books that we have interviewed him on. These would be available in the archives if you're interested. Greg Braden is an internationally renowned pioneer in bridging science and spirituality. In fact, he's my favorite spiritual scientist. He works as a geologist, as a computer system designer for Martin Marietta Defense Systems during the final years of the Cold War. And then he was a operations manager at Cisco, bringing you the Internet. And his books are many and varied, but the ones that we've done together are The Isaiah Effect, The God Code, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, The Divine Matrix, and a book that I haven't done with him yet but hope to sometime, Fractal Time. But today we're going to be talking about Deep Truth, and this is a remarkable book, one that is very, very important for the time we're living in and the questions that people are asking about what is happening now, because everybody is sensing something is happening now. And it is it's a pleasure to have you on, Greg.
Dr. Susan, I am thrilled to be on your program. It's good to hear your voice, and I'm especially honored to know that for the first time now that I'm your favorite spiritual scientist.
You certainly are.
You.
Well, Greg, how did you come up with the title Deep Truth?
You know, the book Deep Truth, it was released in the fall of 2011, Dr. Susan, and it has now been published in 33 languages in over 45 countries, and I've toured many of those countries. And one of the first things I discovered about this book is that the word truth means different things to different people. And I actually have people coming up and saying, you know, what gives you the right to put the word truth in the title of your book? And that's why I think it's important to begin our conversation today by sharing where that title comes from. Generally, when I write a book, I have the title in mind, and I write the book to support that title. And that was the exception for this book. This book was almost finished, and I had no title. I had a working title. And I'd wake up every morning saying, you know, what am I going to call this book? And my publisher was really interested in what I would call it.
Yeah, I bet.
And, yeah, well, they couldn't advertise a book that had no title. And I was reading a biography about Albert Einstein. And it was in a conversation that Albert Einstein was having in the mid-20th century, in the mid-1940s, with his friend and colleague, Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And they were talking about truth, in this case, the nature of scientific truth. And it was the time in our history where new discoveries were almost on a monthly basis. They were being published that were overturning what we had previously believed to be true about physics, about our relationship to ourselves and the world and one another. And it was during one of those conversations that Niels Bohr made a statement, and I'm just going to share the statement. He said, quote, "It is the hallmark of any deep truth that its negation is also a deep truth," end of quote. And I thought about that. It was just so powerful for me to really grasp what Niels Bohr was saying. What he was saying was, when new discoveries overturn what we used to believe were the deepest held truths of our existence, then the new discoveries themselves become the new deep truths. And as soon as I really understood what he was saying, I said, that has to be the title of this book. And that is what this book is all about. It is new discoveries, peer-reviewed scientific discoveries, that are overturning 150-plus years of what science has led us to believe about our relationship to our bodies, to the earth, to our past, to our future, to the world around us, and how we solve our problems. And as I began to understand that, and I was excited. I said, great, science is making all these new discoveries, Dr. Susan, and I would think that people would be thrilled to know that. That's the good news. The flip side of the good news is that there is a reluctance. And what I found, in some cases, an outright resistance to sharing the new discoveries in the mainstream. So mainstream media, mainstream documentaries, mainstream classrooms, mainstream textbooks. it is very, very challenging to get these new discoveries that change the way we think of ourselves into the mainstream. And that's what I'd like to talk with you about today. It would be important at any time in our lives, in the history of our nation, in our world. It's especially critical now because the best minds of our time are telling us very clearly that we're living the greatest number of crises ever to face 5,000 years of human history. Never have we had to solve so many big problems in such a short period of time. So it's a long answer to a short question, but that's where that title comes from, and I think it's a very good title for this book.
It's almost like we're about to graduate into another level of education and responsibility, and as such, all of the textbooks have to be rewritten because we're going to be at a higher level of comprehension and responsibility. And I think that there is always resistance. And it's interesting to me to read about the resistance at the level of the scientific discipline, be it chemistry, biology, physics. It is very, very interesting that that these areas, when the scientists come forth with their discoveries, a lot of times the scientists and even the physicians are maligned, and other people even try to destroy their careers when they bring these deep truths forth and try to publish them.
Sure.
And it was very interesting to me. You know, I've published a couple of books that I didn't do it in the peer-reviewed literature because basically they would never get published, but I published books about the truth about breast implants. And my brother, who is actually a mainstream scientist, he's an atmospheric chemist, said that we were up doing some stuff with the estate, and he said, you know, you and your cousin are very similar in that she is the editor of a rogue physics journal that
oh, wow.
is publishing all these things that are overturning traditional physics. And I said, yay, you know, at least
so it's in your blood
family.
Is what you're telling me.
Right? That's right.
Well,
that's right.
This is why I think it's so important. Science. I was trained as a scientist, and I think science is good. Science certainly does not have all the answers completely wrapped up the way many people would like to believe. Science is a method of allowing us to understand and explore ourselves and our relationship to the world and the past and the future and how things work. And science can only serve us to the degree that we allow it to be honest. And here's what I mean by that. Science is designed to be constantly updated. So when we find new information, peer-reviewed information, not just any old piece of information, but when an idea, a hypothesis, or theory has been thoroughly tested and repeated, and scientists in multiple disciplines have agreed that this way of working is actually the way things work, that information must be incorporated into the scientific story of our relationship to the world and of ourselves to be current and to be accurate. And this is where science is breaking down right now. And I made a statement earlier, and I want to clarify this because I think this is important. When I said there's a reluctance in the mainstream, and I mentioned teachers in classrooms, I want to say very clearly it's not the teacher's fault that they're not being allowed to share this new information. In the United States, it's not like this in all the countries I go to, but in the United States of America, every teacher is bound, in public schools, is bound by a covenant with the state that they teach within. And unless the information is approved, part of an approved curricula by the school board, they cannot share it. So even
right.
though the new discoveries have been peer-reviewed and they're accepted in certain scientific circles, until the mainstream accepts that, until the school boards allow that information to be shared, the teachers are required to essentially teach a science that's obsolete. Now, that would be important and worth talking about at any time, but it's crucial right now because of where we find ourselves, the context, where we find ourselves in the history of our nation and our world. We are facing the greatest crises that have the potential to forever change life, and in some cases in life, when it comes to war and peace, in life as we know it. Big problems. And the thinking that led to those problems is the thinking that now is being shown to be based upon false assumptions of science. So if we do not update our model of our relationship to the world and how we solve our problems, then the solutions are going to come from the same thinking that led to the problems. And we know what that world looks like because we're living it right now. So we're asking our young people, we're giving our young people at the very best, an incomplete view of the world. And in some cases, we're giving them a view that is incorrect, in leaving them to believe that they are powerless when it comes to the condition of their bodies, for example, and we can talk about that a little bit, or when it comes to the way they think of themselves in the world. We have all been led to believe that we live in a world based on what Charles Darwin called survival of the strongest, later interpreted as survival of the fittest. We hear it as dog-eat-dog, and it is that thinking that our economic system is based upon. It's collapsing. The corporate systems are based upon that are breaking down. It's that thinking that is leading to the big wars that are percolating in the Middle East right now. And if we apply the same thinking that led to those crises, and as we try to work them out, we know where that's going to lead. So it's not the teacher's fault, and it's important that we honor the science that we have asked to help us understand our world by updating it when these new discoveries become visible. And I think maybe the thing to do at some point here would be to share some examples of those assumptions, the false assumptions, and what the new discoveries are telling us.
You have five false assumptions here in one of the first chapters.
Yeah.
And you want to share those?
Maybe the thing to do would just be go through them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
There are, as I was researching the book, Deep Truth, what I found is that there are a number of scientific assumptions that we now know today are just that. They're false assumptions, but they're still being taught as fact in the classroom. I chose five that I felt are having the greatest impact in our world today, the greatest impact on our lives and preventing us from finding viable solutions to big problems and personal problems in our own lives. So what I'd like to do, Dr. Seuss, let me just go through these five false assumptions. Then we can zero in on a couple that I think are really pivotal in our lives today, and let's see where that takes us. You okay if we do it that way?
That's fine.
Okay, so these five assumptions. The first one is a Darwinian assumption about evolution. When I was in school, and our young people there are being taught that evolution explains life in general, where DNA came from and how life originated, and it explains human life specifically. The problem with this is the data no longer supports this assumption, but the data, the new facts, are not being allowed to be shared in the classroom along with this existing assumption. So that's the first false assumption, that evolution explains life and evolution explains human life. The second false assumption is about civilization itself. When I was in school back in the 60s and the 70s, I was taught that civilization is only about 5,000 years old, maybe a little 5,500 years old, that it is linear, that it essentially began in a primitive state 5,000 years ago, and that we have evolved to the pinnacle of technology and sophistication that we see today, that it happened once, and that prior to that, not much was going on. The problem is that peer-reviewed archaeological data simply doesn't support this. There are now accepted archaeological sites of advanced civilizations are being found on multiple continents, in Peru, in South America, in the deserts of Egypt. We're finding them in Turkey, a couple of sites in Turkey, off the coast of India, underneath 120 feet of water, and other places. Evidence of advanced civilization, these aren't little stone homes. I mean, these are huge sites in Peru, 150-acre site with five pyramids and two circular plazas that predate the oldest thing of any sites in any of the Americas. That's going to be important in just a few minutes, but I'm just saying this is one of the false assumptions. But we're being taught that civilization is only about 5,000 years old. It's a one-time deal. Key assumptions number three and four are actually related. They're based in ideas of physics. Number three, we're being taught that consciousness is somehow separate from our physical world. And number four, we're being taught that the space between things is essentially empty. So the space between the nucleus and the first electron of an atom, we're told, is empty space. Or the space between you and the person next to you in the room that's listening to this broadcast. And that is changing in some places, but to a large extent, in most public schools, we're being taught that those things are true, that consciousness is separate from our world and that space between things is empty. The physics is showing us just the opposite. It's showing us that consciousness is actually the stuff that our physical world emerges from. And pioneering physicists like John Wheeler from Princeton University, he was a colleague of Einstein's. He was the one that made these kinds of statements. He said, we cannot separate consciousness from the physical world around us. And when we do, we write ourselves right out of the equation of the universe. So that's number three and four. And number five is another Darwinian assumption. It's last on this list, but I think it might be the one we want to explore first because it has such a powerful impact in our lives. Darwin said that nature is based upon a model of what he called survival of the strongest. Later it was interpreted as survival of the fittest. He made that statement in 1859 as modern civilization. The foundation of modern civilization was developing. So although we're in the early years of the 21st century, the world that we have built, the systems we've come to rely upon, are largely improvements of systems that were actually put in place in the late 1800s. Based upon the ideas that were available at that time, and this idea of survival of the strongest is one of the most dangerous ways of thinking. But these are five key assumptions that we talk about in the new book, Deep Truth.
So when we look at how our health is not really being looked after by the FDA and the medical industry, but it's more about money, it's more about medicine is more about the pharmaceutical, pushing the pharmaceuticals coming out of the major corporations than it is about, you know, educating people about how to take care of their bodies. These all come out of the survival of the fittest, then.
They do, and when we look, the reason these are important is because consciously or subconsciously, when we think about ourselves and when we solve our problems, we do so by answering a question. It's a question that has been fundamental to every civilization that's ever existed. We don't always wake up and consciously ask this question of ourselves, but it is nonetheless it is a question that is absolutely key in the way we solve our problems. And the question is simply, who are we? And we define who we are as individuals, consciously or subconsciously, as a civilization, by answering what are called the six perennial questions. So when we ask a question, where does life come from? Where does human life come from? What is our relationship to our body? This ties into the question you just asked. What is our relationship to the world? What is our relationship to the past and how we solve our problems? How do we solve our problems? The way we answer those questions becomes the lens through which we think of ourselves and the lens in our relationship to the world and the lens through which we will make all of our decisions. So this is important because the false assumptions have led us to believe that life is just a random occurrence, that human life is a random occurrence, that our relationship to our body is that we're separate and powerless. Our relationship to the world is that we're separate and independent from the world around us. Our relationship to the past is that civilization is a one-way deal and we're at the top of the heap right now, and that the way that we solve our problems is through competition in conflict. So those false assumptions are based upon the way that science has looked at our world for the last 150 years. The new discoveries change all that. They show us that life isn't random, that human life isn't random, that we're connected, deeply connected with our bodies, that we are deeply interdependent with the earth, that our relationship to the past is a cyclic relationship. It's not linear. And this is the key, that we solve our problems based upon a model in nature that is based upon cooperation and mutual aid. Nature is not based upon this idea of constant struggle and survival of the strongest. And this is what Darwin asked us to believe. This is what our civilization is largely based upon. We've learned to solve our problems through this idea of conflict and competition. Our economic system is based upon this idea of survival of the strongest and competition. And this is why these things are collapsing the way they are. They're no longer sustainable in their present form, the way the world is today. So this is why you mentioned specifically our bodies, and our bodies, our relationship to our body is one facet of this way of thinking that we have been asked to embrace. And in all honesty, Dr. Susan, I mean, it served us well enough for 150 years or so to bring us to the point where we are now. It served us well enough. We have a world that has worked to the degree that it's worked. And now that the world is changing, the way we have learned to be in the past is no longer working. And that's what's causing so many of the crises that we see in the world today. So the world changed. We no longer live in isolated countries or isolated economies with isolated technologies and energy and defense and communications. And that changes the way we think of money and jobs and careers. It changes the way we think of security, religion, medicine, and health. All of those things are now changing because the world that we have come to rely upon and trust, that world is changing very, very quickly. So that's why I think it's important to put this in context. These things, they'd be important any time, but they're critical right now because of the context of where we find ourselves in the world.
And especially now that we're coming to the end of probably at least three major cycles, it's important to understand the cyclical nature of existence. And I love the part of your book when you look at temperature and CO2 records, and actually show that this global warming and global cooling is cyclical and probably has very little to do with humans in general.
It's important to know the truth if we're going to address this, but we also have to be very, very careful, very cautious. And when I'm on a stage in front of a live audience, this is one of those places, Dr. Susan, I have to say very clearly, my opinion, we definitely need to clean up our act. And we need to find clean, sustainable ways of fueling our economy. But what we've been told is that we created, this is the language, we created global warming. So we have to fix it. And the data clearly shows that global warming, we can look at 500,000 years of ice cores from Antarctica, and we can see the rise and the fall of global temperatures based upon Earth's location in space, Earth's relationship to the sun. And we can see how it correlates to the greenhouse gases. So have we contributed to those gases? I have to say yes, because we're putting stuff into the atmosphere. We're definitely contributing. But did we cause the warming, and did the gases cause the warming? And the data clearly shows the answer is no, and a lot of scientists simply don't have the platform from which to share their message, and the message is no, we didn't cause it. What the data clearly shows is there are cycles within cycles within cycles, and the warming cycles are generally intense, which we are living now. They're generally short-lived, Dr. Susan. The warming doesn't go on and on and on, and it's what comes after the warming that's the bigger problem than the warming itself, the cooling cycle.
Right.
That comes after the warming, because the cooling generally affects the northern hemisphere, where most people live and where most of our food is grown. But where this is key is when we look at what the data is actually telling us, it shows that the temperatures actually increase before the greenhouse gases increase, and there's a lag time of between 4 and as much as 800 years, which means the gases cannot be the cause for the warming. And this is important because when leaders get together, like the Copenhagen Climate Summit of 2010, it's so interesting to me because there's such an opportunity. In my opinion, it was an opportunity missed, and I talk about this in the book. The leaders themselves got into that room. They walked into the room. And they had the opportunity. They could have. Here's what could have happened. They could have sat down and looked at one another and said, in all honesty, look, we don't fully understand global warming, but it is a fact. It's happening. It's affecting our nations. It's affecting our commerce. It's affecting our economies. People are losing their way of life. They're losing their homes as entire communities are wiped from shoreside from shorelines and in these superstorms. They're losing their lives. Let's transcend the differences that have separated us in the past. Let's work together beyond our differences and help our people get through this rare cycle of climate change, and let's see where that leads. That's what could have happened. What did happen, the reality, was that those leaders and their surrogates got together in the room and they began pointing fingers at one another and placing blame upon one another based on the false science that said humans created the global warming.
Right.
And they began trying to assign financial penalties, which caused so many hard feelings, they left that climate summit with very little agreement, and it made it difficult. It left hard feelings, made it difficult for the nations to work together to help their people. So that is an example of the danger of false assumptions of science and how it can prevent levels of cooperation that I feel are possible if we were simply honest with one another about what it is that's happening here. And that's just one example that I give in the book. So when we look at all of these things, all of these false assumptions are important. I want to zero in on the one we just alluded to. This is number five, that nature is based on survival of the strongest. And before I do that, I want to say just a couple words about Charles Darwin. I'm not down on Darwin at all. I think he was a scientist. I think he was probably I know he was a scientist. I think he was probably a pretty good scientist. And Darwin attempted to do something in his time that had never been done before. He attempted to answer those big questions that we just asked. Where does life come from? Where's human life come from? What's our relationship to our body and the world and the past and how do things work around here? He tried to answer it for the first time through the language of science. Prior to his time in 1859, all those questions were answered in the religious community and by the church. So Darwin took the first stab at answering these questions through the language of science. In my opinion, this is the mistake Darwin made. He took the observations that he made for some forms of life in some parts of the world, and he tried to apply them to all life everywhere, including humans. And the problem is the data simply doesn't support that. So, for example, he looked at colonies of ants, and he saw large ants that would capture smaller colonies of ants, but they didn't kill them. They made slaves out of them, and they made them work. Or he looked at two birds, siblings, in a nest, and another bird that was different would come into that nest, and in that moment, he saw the siblings kick the other bird out of the nest and leave it to die. So Darwin believed, when he saw things like that happening, that he was looking at little examples of a general law that applies to everybody, everywhere, and that law was for us to essentially multiply, vary, let the strongest live and the weakest die. This was Darwin's own language. And it's such a dangerous way of thinking, because what it says is that Darwin saw the world through the eyes of struggle, and so he interpreted the world through the eyes of struggle and everything that he saw. That idea is, as we just mentioned, it's the foundation of our civilization today. It's the basis for some of the most horrendous atrocities that humans have committed against other humans in the last 150 years. Many of the genocides in the 20th and now the 21st century are based upon Darwin's way of thinking. They say because this is science, it justifies us eliminating inferior members of our population based upon these ideas. I'm sure Darwin never knew his ideas were going to be used that way. But this is the danger of these false assumptions and how they can be interpreted and where they're used and why I think it's important to honor the new discoveries. So, the new discoveries are showing us beyond any reasonable doubt. 400 peer-reviewed studies are showing that the optimum amount of competition in any situation is zero. In the classroom, in the playing field, in the family, in the workplace, that nature is based upon this model of cooperation and not violent competition. So this is where I need to say just a couple of words about competition itself, because it means different things to different people. But there are two forms of competition. And one form is where an individual or a group benefits at the expense of another. It's where an individual or a group exploits the weaknesses of another. That's one form of competition. There's another form where an individual or a group benefit by excelling at their own skills. In other words, they develop their own abilities to the greatest degree, and by doing so, they make the other ways of doing things obsolete, but they are not exploiting the weakness of others. Buckminster Fuller described this beautifully when he said the only way to bring about real change, he says, if you want real change in your world, he said, develop a new way of doing things that makes the old way obsolete. That is a form of competition, but it's not violent competition. So new discovery, those 400 peer-reviewed studies, New Scientist, very prestigious journal, New Scientist, April of 2008, Michael LePage did a beautiful write-up. And what he said is, and this is a quote, he said, what we see in the wild is not every animal out for itself. He said that cooperation is a viable survival strategy, and that when cooperation breaks down, the results can become disastrous. So this is science now telling us that while violent competition happens, we all see it, it's not the rule. It's not the law of nature. It happens in response to, it's an aberration of the rule of nature. It happens in response to certain conditions. And then when I think about you, Dr. Susan, and your this program and what you do and your clients and your patients, our bodies are such beautiful examples of precisely what the new science is showing. There are about 50 trillion cells in the average human body, and every one of those cells must work at a level of cooperation that allows us to have the health and vitality that we like to have every day. And when that cooperation breaks down, we get what we call disease, and if it goes far enough, the disease leads to death. So if the very essence of our lives, of the bodies that house the consciousness that's listening to this broadcast right now, nature is showing us the deepest truth of the level of cooperation, how deep it goes, and it goes to the very basis of life itself. And I think that is a very, very new idea for a lot of people. If we can embrace that deep truth and then apply it to the big problems in our world, that changes everything. So that was another long answer to a short question, but I wanted to say all that so we can tie into it for the rest of the program.
Well, Greg, I went to a very competitive college, and everybody was engaged in fierce competition. And I formed a study group, and we studied together. And by doing so, all of us were able to do very, very well. And I think I introduced, probably for the first time in that school, the idea that people sharing their study time and sharing their intuitive, I think it's more intuitive way of attacking the vast amount of materials we were trying to master really had a great effect on being able to take the test successfully. And I think it
I wish I'd known you when I was in school.
I did the same thing in medical school, and it actually worked very well. Many people said that it really made things enjoyable because it's just more enjoyable to do difficult tasks together than it is separately.
Excuse me. It is. And it, even beyond that, I think it makes sense. I think most people intuitively, subconsciously, we've all heard we live in a dog-eat-dog world. That's the languaging in the West. Other countries have other languages that they use, but it's very similar thinking in the Western traditions. This is huge. When we really get that we live in a world of cooperation and mutual aid, it's not a world that's out to get us. I mean, it's easy to see the world that way. It's easy to think that way. And we ask ourselves, you know, where did that thinking even come from? I want to share something here. Darwin's first book, this is important. The first book he wrote, 1859, where a lot of these ideas came from, and they're being required to be taught in the schools today, and they're forbidding any competing theories to be shared alongside these ideas. Okay, they're all based on this book. It was titled, and most of our listeners are probably familiar with the common title. It is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. I think we've all heard of that. A lot of us, it was required reading. What gets really interesting is that's not the full title. And it was early in the 20th century, the rest of the title was relegated to the inner pages, so it's not obvious until you open the book. And it begins with the word or, the rest of the title. So here's the full title: The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That was Darwin's original title. The reason I think that's important is because it gives us insight into his thinking. Darwin, he said, the preservation of favored races. He saw some races that he felt were stronger and would always win out over others. And we said in the struggle for life, he viewed life as a struggle. So everything that he saw, he interpreted through the eyes of this predisposed idea that life is a struggle. So we've been led to believe that life is a struggle. Where people are really seeing us now, it's the economic system. It's our global economic system based on survival of the strongest, where it's an idea, it's a model of scarcity. It's a model that says there's only so many pieces of the pie to go around. That model is collapsing, and it's collapsing because it is an unsustainable model, and it does not reflect the true essence of the nature that we live in. So it has worked well enough in the past to bring us to the point we are now. If we're going to really find a solution to the way that things are working right now, that model has to reflect this idea of cooperation and mutual aid. The way we've solved our big problems, everyone feels there's a push for a big war in the Middle East right now. And a lot of people think that war is going to help the economy of the world, which is a really sad statement to make. What they're missing is that it is the idea of survival of the strongest and this model of competition that has laid the fertile ground for that war, and that peace is such a powerful, viable economy, the potential for that. But if we try to solve the big issues that are happening right now through this old model of survival of the strongest, we've outgrown that model. And the wars of the past, where someone wins and someone loses, that becomes obsolete. Everyone loses in the wars from this point forward because of the nature of war, the nature of technology that's used, the nature of the weapons. And it's no longer about borders and clearly defined ideas. These are about very nebulous ideas. So, and we talk about this in more detail in the book, but this is where this idea, nature based on survival of the fittest, survival of the strongest, is so deeply ingrained. But what I'd like to do, Dr. Susan, if I could, I want to go back. This now ties in. We talked about civilization, and we've been taught it's only 5,000 years old. Well, the new archaeology, peer-reviewed archaeology, is showing us evidence of these advanced civilizations, the oldest one now right around 13,000 years before present, right at the end of the last ice age. But what I didn't say, and this is what's so interesting, there's a mystery that is threading its way through every one of these ancient civilizations that cannot be explained by conventional thinking. And the mystery is this: the archaeologists have yet to find any evidence of war, large-scale war. They've yet to find any evidence of weapons. They've yet to find any evidence of the need to defend homes and communities. There are no walls built around these places. There are no moats built or fences built around the homes. There's no mass graves that you would expect to find after big war with mutilated bodies, as we do find in other places. So the interesting thing, the civilizations that are older than what we are told is the beginning of civilization. So we're told 5,000 years ago is when it began. The civilizations that are older than 5,000 years, the common thread that runs through them, whether we're talking about northern Peru or Egypt or Turkey, Bolivia, or off the coast of India, as different as they are from one another, there's no evidence of any war. And archaeologists and anthropologists now are beginning to suspect that war, violent competition, survival of the strongest, is a habit that was learned at the beginning of our cycle of civilization 5,000 years ago, that it is not really human nature. And this parallels many of our most cherished indigenous traditions. Our ancestors told us that before our cycle of time that began in the biblical era 5,000 years ago, our ancestors told us there was another cycle. It was what they called the Golden Age. It was a cycle of peace and healing. People lived to advanced ages. They learned to honor their relationship to the earth and the food and their bodies. And that it was 5,000 years ago when the earth went through a period of climate change, very similar to what we're going through now, that people, for mysterious reasons, I don't know the answer to why this happened, but they began to compete for the disappearing resources in a new way rather than cooperate to share the way they had in the past. And when that competition began, we launched a cycle of war and suffering and darkness that our ancestors say ends this year, 2012. That was the big thing for them. This is the end of this cycle. And the beginning of the next cycle, and the big question, is will we perpetuate the habit of war and suffering and the scarcity and the model of lack that has been the hallmark of this cycle and the war that's come along with it? Or will we embrace the deepest truths of our existence? Nature is based upon a model of cooperation and mutual aid. I don't know the answer to the question, but we are determining that answer by the choices we make and by the way we live our lives, the way we solve our big problems today. And that brings us right back to where we started at the beginning of this program. Our own science is now telling us that we have been mistaken, and in some cases, wrong, in 150 years of the story about our relationship to the earth. And the best science of our time, through peer-reviewed research, is giving us very good reasons to think differently, to change the way we think about our bodies and our relationship to the earth. What does healing mean to us, and how do we really solve our problems? If we have the wisdom to embrace those new discoveries, then that becomes the foundation of this new cycle of experience. And our ancestors said they couldn't tell us how that would happen. The Hopi that I've spent time with, the Tibetan monks and the nuns in the highlands of central China, the shaman in the southern Andes, all these people, none of them could tell us exactly how this cycle would turn out, because they said we're cheating it right now by the way we live our lives. So that makes all of this very, very current, very present. And that's what I wanted to share on your program today.
It certainly does. At the end of the book, you have a diagram called the Hierarchy of Thinking, which I found very interesting. Would you like to comment on that?
Ooh, I'd have to get my book and look at it.
Okay.
Here,
well,
the hierarchy of thinking.
It's on one side. It says thinking based in false assumptions of science, going from how we solve problems through conflict, force, and competition, all the way up to the origin of life being random occurrence and chance.
Okay.
Whereas
sure.
on the other side, you have thinking based in new discoveries of science. And again, at the beginning, the origin of life, you have directed process of design, and then it goes down to solving problems through cooperation,
right,
understanding, and mutual aid. And I'm pointing this out because it really is it really points to every single thing we covered: the origin of life, the origin of human life, relationship to our body, relationship to the world, history of civilization, and then the tipping point of the crisis that you just described. And it really comes down to how we're thinking about, I mean, are we living in a world where everything is random and everything is by chance, or are we living in a directed process of design?
Absolutely.
That's a critical question.
You know, it's not like everyone wakes up every morning and the first thing on their mind is, you know, the question, who am I? And it's not like we sit with our families at the breakfast table or think about it while we're brushing our teeth or talk about our coworkers, but subconsciously, deeply ingrained from our families, our friends, our communities, our spiritual traditions, our lifestyles, all of those deeply ingrained are the answers. We've all been programmed to answer these big questions of life. And the way that that programming has come to us, either consciously or subconsciously, that becomes, it literally is the lens through which we look at the world and how we go about answering every challenge, every crisis, every relationship, if it's working, if it's not, if our job works, if it's not, how we, what kind of food we eat, how we live our lives, all of those things. Because we say, what does it mean to me? And the way we answer, what does it mean to me, is through the way that we have been led to think of ourselves. Where does life come from? Where does human life come from? What is our relationship to our bodies? That this program is all about that. We've been led to believe that we're separate from our bodies. We're powerless.
Right.
I mean, and this is changing, but we're relatively powerless. I remember I was a competitive runner, Dr. Susan, back in the late 70s through the early 90s. And it was in the 80s. I was running competitively for corporations, like on their triathlon teams and like AT&T. Mm-hmm. I was a geologist at Phillips Petroleum. So Phillips Petroleum would have a corporate team that would compete against AT&T or US West or IBM or whatever. And I was doing it almost every weekend. And I remember I had, as my first injury, first time I'd ever had a knee injury that prevented me from running. And all the years I was running, it never happened. And I remember I went to a doctor. And, you know, I've got my holistic ways of thinking about things, and I don't talk about them all the time, but I just assumed in the 80s everybody believed as I did. So I remember I asked my doctor, I said, what is it that I could visualize that would help my knee heal quicker so I could be competing again sooner? And the doctor looked at me and he said, you can visualize whatever you want to visualize. It's not going to make a damn bit of difference. Your leg's going to heal whenever it's going to heal.
Right.
And I remember thinking to myself, this little subconscious voice said, ooh, wrong doctor.
Right, exactly.
But it was a beautiful example. And, you know, he's a very nice man. He's a friend, and, you know, I still continue to go to him. But what it told me was, although we don't talk about it outwardly, that his thinking about his relationship to his body and his clients' relationships to their bodies, it was based in a scientific story that's been perpetuated for about 150
right.
years, and it was very different than the way I was thinking about mine. And that story says that we're separate, independent, and powerless. And now the best science of our time is changing all of that. It's telling us that we are deeply connected, deeply intertwined, and that through things like epigenetics. I know you've had guests on your program talking about epigenetics. Our thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs literally influence the chemistry of our bodies, and including things like the immune response and how quickly we heal and how resistant we are to you know, picking up things that other people around us seem to be picking up. And
the future of medicine, spiritual medicine, if you came to me with that knee injury, I would say, well, most knee injuries occur because you're not listening to your higher self. What spiritual message are you blocking there? And have you meditate on that? And then maybe if you started listening to that, your knee would heal in record time.
Well,
and if you didn't
precisely.
Listen to it, you'd re-injure it.
But see, this is, and so this, maybe this will bring, and I'm conscious that our program is probably nearing the end of our time together.
It
but
is,
this,
yeah.
This is the place, people ask me many times in the live audiences. I've been out of the country five times in the last 6 weeks in international audiences. People say, Greg, are you going to talk about spiritual things today? And my answer to them, because they've read the book Deep Truth, and they said, well, that's not a spiritual book, that's about the world. And my answer is, what could possibly be more spiritual than applying in the world we live in the principles that we claim to hold in our hearts and our minds about our relationship to the world? I think this is the opportunity. It's where the rubber meets the road. The spiritual rubber of our beliefs meets the road of the real world. And if we're ever going to apply in our lives what we claim to be true in our hearts and minds, this is a perfect time because we are living a world of crisis, and that's where the new paradigm begins. What that paradigm looks like is determined by us and the choices that we make. So that's what I wanted to say today, and as we talk about this book, and I so appreciate you making the time, Dr. Susan. I know you're a very busy woman. You do some amazing work, and to make the time to have a conversation for an hour about things, I respect
well,
that,
thank
and
you.
I have a deep, deep gratitude. Thank you so much for making that possible.
Well, thank you. Would you like to give your contact information for our listeners?
The website is, it's a very easy one to remember. It's www.gregbraden.com. That's Greg with two G's, GREGGBRADEN.com. All the event schedule up through 2013 actually is on that, as well as there's a video library if you'd like to see video clips of live programs where we're exploring the principles in the books that we've just talked about. Those are all available. Beautiful interactive newsletter, a lot of good information on that website. So I invite our listeners, if you'd like to know more, that's a good place to begin.
And you are involved in the I Can Do It workshops that I assume are still going on?
I am, and thank you for that. My publisher is Hay House, and Hay House is more than just a publisher. They have become a family, bring together some of the most brilliant minds and beautiful hearts who I now am privileged to call my friends and colleagues. Everyone in a different way, because each person learns so differently. It's important to have information coming in a lot of different ways. So a lot of different information there, but it is a beautiful family of dedicated and devoted individuals and a publisher who really supports the vision of a world of healing, a world of peace, a world of cooperation, and is willing to put the energy behind that to bring that message to a larger audience. They also manage my website, so it's a beautiful website, and they're the ones that have made all the interactive materials on there. So, and these conferences, they five times a year, in a live venue, either in Canada or the United States or Australia, is where they're holding these really very well done conferences. In one day, an individual has an opportunity to see a myriad different perspectives, the same general language about helping us to become better people and create a better world, but from so many different perspectives, and they do it really well. So I'm honored to be on that stage and honored to share it with so many of those people who have been my heroes, who I now have the privilege of calling my friends.
Yeah, it was a great event in Atlanta. We've already had the one in Atlanta, but if you go online, you can see if there's other events in other places around the United States and Canada that you might make.
Yeah, I think the one more this year, we just finished in Toronto, and the last one this year will be in Washington, D.C. in the fall.
So that's not too far away. You can drive there in about 10 hours.
And they begin next year. Yeah. So,
right.
So they do a beautiful job, and it's a powerful message.
It is. It is. I enjoyed it a great deal. Well, Greg, thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us today. And hopefully we can get you back on to do Fractal Time.
You know, I would be honored to come back on. We don't have to have a new book. I mean, there's so much material in this one. We could do a whole other program.
We can do the whole thing. That's true. We just touched the
surface.
And
I want to thank that engineer working behind the scenes that makes all this possible for holding us together today. Thank you so much.
All right, right. Well, thanks, Greg. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've had Greg Braden on talking about deep truth, igniting the memory of our origin, history, destiny, and fate. And please join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.